Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to you all. This is the Business Day Spotlight, your destination for African business made simple. My name is Mudiwa Gawaza, and for today, we are getting into, some of the possible considerations around this year's national budget. Obviously, if you're listening to this, you know that just a couple of days ago, we are recording this on the 21st of February. You'll know that the budget speech was meant to be held 2 days prior, which was the 19th of February, and that did not, end up happening. However, that does not stop people, from still having their concerns and things that they are looking out for when it comes to that particular budget for the year. And for today, we are joined by Kurt Yo, who is the co-founder of Vaping Saved Save My Life, consumer advocacy group. They are known as VSML, and we're going to maybe get an understanding of the types of things that Kurt is looking out for when it comes to the budget speech, because we know that when it comes to the budget speech, one of the ways in which government it tends to be able to draw money in many years is around what are called sin taxes. And your sin taxes tend to be the taxes around alcohol and tobacco products, but I think we will hear the story to say where do they stand as a VSML, and maybe getting a sense of by the time that the budget speech comes up on the 12th of March, what are the types of considerations that they're advocating for, and where do things stand right now, and what type of future could we possibly have. Kurt, greetings to you today.
Good morning, Madiwe, and good morning to your listeners.
VSML, Vaping Saved My Life Consumer Advocacy Group, that seems to encapsulate everything in the name. But maybe you could just give us a little bit of a sense, just so that people, fully get a fuller understanding of what it is that you are working on and the types of issues that you are concerning yourself with on a daily basis.
Well, VSML was basically started by myself and a fellow vapor in 2017. And it started off as a Facebook testimonial page where we asked individuals who were former smokers and now vapers to provide some input into why they believe vaping was a critical part in helping them quit smoking. And that eventually became bigger and more, for lack of a better word, more encompassing. Is we started focusing on a lot of issues around myths and facts around vaping. And then obviously in 2018, the National Department of Health introduced its tobacco bill, the new tobacco bill, tobacco products and electronic nicotine delivery systems control bill, which you need to take a deep breath before and after stating that bill. So we started getting involved in understanding a whole host of things around the policies and regulations that want to be put in place. And we became a bit more vocal around some of the issues that have been raised around electronics, nicotine delivery systems, which we call vapes. So we do get involved with activities that directly talk to policies and regulations around these products in South Africa.
For someone who's perhaps uninitiated to electronic cigarettes, vaping, is there a set definition of what vaping is in South Africa or in the world? And I ask that simply because when a person is out and about, I have a number of people, colleagues, friends, people that I know that, vape, but the shape of these things tends to be different. Some of the two, I think you mentioned it earlier on, delivery mechanisms, they tend to look differently. Is there a set box confines within which we make this definition, or do we look at it broadly to say anything that is delivering tobacco within an electronic sense, this is what you are concerned with and talking about?
So in essence, if we look at it at a very high level, it's the delivery of nicotine or non-nicotine without combustion. Combustion is the key premise here, or the key differentiator, is that when it comes to vaping or electronic nicotine delivery systems, there is no combustion. And we've known for decades that combustion is what kills the user over a long period of time. When you remove the combustion from the equation, you're immediately removing a majority of the risk and harm. So if you look, for example, at a vape, because we have a whole host of products that fall under the category of electronic delivery systems. So we got heat not burn, which is literally a tobacco product that is not burning the tobacco. It's heating the tobacco to create an aerosol. It removes the unwanted toxins and carcinogenics from combustion. But on our side, we look at, for example, vaping. And vaping is the heating of an e-liquid or a liquid, which is water-soluble, into an aerosol. And inside that liquid contains four main ingredients or components. We've got propylene glycol, vegetable glycerin, flavorants, and the optional nicotine. Those liquids are heated at a particular temperature to produce an aerosol. The aerosol is inhaled, and that is the delivery of, and it's a delivery of the nicotine is through an aerosol that is not generated or created from combustion.
When it comes to, now that we have a firm, I guess, definition of what's being spoken about within the broader umbrella, and then more specifically, what VSML is looking out for, where does vaping sit on the spectrum of syntaxes at the moment?
Well, at the moment, I mean, we're looking at a syntax. When you say spectrum, what are you referring to?
Because once again, we've taken time to define vaping within the context of, you know, electronic cigarettes and non-combustion,
yes,
right? So I'm saying on the spectrum of syntaxes, because it tends to be alcohol and tobacco, right? How is government firstly defining this, and also where does it sit in terms of how the government has imposed taxes around things like vaping?
So at the moment, since June 2023, the government implemented a per volume tax or excise on any liquid with or without nicotine that is for the intent or purpose to use in these products, an e-liquid. So in June 2023, it was R2.90 per mol, irrespective of the nicotine content. Without nicotine, it can still be R2.90. That was then adjusted literally within 6 months to R3.04 per mol. And we were waiting to see with the new budget how that is going to be increased or what the rate would be based on that. VSML has always been very, very vocal in the fact that there should be no tax on these products whatsoever, given the fact that we have such a large number of individuals in this country who do smoke combustible cigarettes. And in order for us, what we believe is, in order for us to help those numbers reduce, we need to make these products affordable, effective, and acceptable. So we've always believed that in order for us to have as many people who smoke move over to safe alternatives, price plays a very important role. By increasing this, it does make it difficult for a person to justify a switch, particularly in an environment where there's such a large illicit cigarette trade, where cigarettes are incredibly cheap. Now we have a product that's introduced a tax that will make it significantly far more expensive than even normal cigarettes. The other issue is that, for example, majority of people that vape or switch over to vaping start at a very high level of nicotine, and they work their way down, much the same as we see with nicotine replacement therapies. Unfortunately, when it comes to the way these products are designed and manufactured, very strong levels of nicotine are usually found in smaller volumes. But as you work your way down to, let's say, for example, a 3 milligram, you buy these products in bigger volumes, which immediately makes these particular products exceptionally expensive. So it forces people to not go down the nicotine route, but stay on the highest levels of nicotine purely based on the volume. If there was any way that we couldn't avoid the tax, I would have recommended a tax based on the nicotine strength and not on the volume. So higher nicotine products would have a higher tax rate than low nicotine products. And we will work away all the way down to a zero nicotine, which effectively shouldn't really have tax if we consider that the only reason why we're taxing these products is to ensure that people don't get hooked on these products, particularly the youth. But unfortunately, I don't believe that is working at all.
Am I understanding you correctly to say part of the advocacy is to say, if we're going to be switching South African cigarette smokers over to a safer alternative, which in this case is vaping, then we need to incentivize that switch, and that incentivizing comes, you know, in the form of a price, because vaping tends to be, I guess by nature, more expensive, you know, per unit than cigarettes, which can literally be bought in singles. On the street sometimes, and that you're also arguing that people in them switching over to vaping tend to start with products that have a high level of nicotine, because you're basically taking combustion into non-combustion, and then you are saying that over time someone is looking to reduce the nicotine content. But as they're reducing the nicotine content, they're possibly increasing the amount of vaping that they're doing with lower nicotine products. So as they switch over to the lower nicotine content products, those products should come in at a cheaper rate, because a person is buying a higher number of them, you know, as they're making that switch. So let's rather tax according to nicotine content. The lower the content, the lower the tax, because a person is buying, you know, all of this product at lower nicotine content. So, you know, to encourage that overall journey where they are reducing the nicotine content, right, then, you know, that should also come with a commensurate price drop when per unit.
Absolutely. Let's just look at another model, which is maybe not related at all, but if we look at Vitality, a program that is used by many individuals, is that the more activities you do, the more things that you do, the more points that you get, and the better discounts and the better levels that you get. So we should encourage people that, listen, first of all, switch over. If you're a smoker, I never ever have I ever advocated for vaping for a non-nicotine or nicotine-naive individual, and especially the kids. I talk directly to individuals who smoke cigarettes or smoke tobacco, combustible tobacco. So what we should be looking at is finding ways and means of having these people either quit completely, which is proven to be grossly inefficient and ineffective with the methods that we use. Look at ways and methods of helping these people switch to a safer alternative. Vaping is not the only safer alternative out there. But when they start, typically based on the data that we've seen and based on our own user experiences, is that individuals who do switch to a higher level of nicotine. And over time, they will naturally, when everything is fair, reduce their nicotine strength. So if I take my own story, I started at a very high level of nicotine 11 years ago. I slowly but surely worked my way down to what I now consider as a perfectly normal rate of nicotine, which is a 2 milligrams of nicotine. However, when we start introducing a tax on per volume, in order for me to purchase a 2 milligram nicotine, I have to buy large volume bottles. They usually come in 60 mils or 100 mils. If I was buying something, for example, a 50 milligrams, those are typically what we see in disposable vapes, and those are 2 mils. So if we add, for example, let's just say R3 to a 2 mil disposable, that's an additional R6 to that product. It's not going to break many people's banks. But if we add that 3 rand to a 100 ml bottle of 2 milligrams, we're now talking an additional 300 rand on top of the product. So you're not incentivizing people going down the nicotine route to a point where they consider it to be normal. You know, nicotine is not the danger here. Yes, nicotine is dependent forming, but it doesn't create the harm. It's the combustion that creates the harm. But if in order for us wanting to have people go down that route to a point where they actually can quit altogether, we have to work our way down the nicotine, the dependence route, for them to have an escape route into being completely abstinent. And we also need to acknowledge that for many people around the world, particularly in South Africa, nicotine is something that they need, something that they enjoy, something that they find value in their life. For example, myself, I think nicotine provides value in my life. It provides benefits to me. But I don't want to be forced to a 50 milligram nicotine or a 35 milligram nicotine because I find that really problematic. I'd like to work my way down to a point where I think nicotine is helpful rather than being a problem. I've gone through that route. If we introduce a tax per volume, in my again, I don't believe there should be a tax on this product, then it forces many people who do not have that kind of income or kind of money at hand to work their way down. They have to stay at those very high levels of nicotine, which I think is cruel. We should be able to give people the option to move down if they want to.
Very curious then to understand everything that you've just explained makes logical sense, especially if we're saying that there's corners on a national level, to reduce the amount of nicotine that is being consumed, in the country. Where are you in terms of, because you are an advocacy group, where are you in terms of those engagements, with the government, with the authorities, with people that are crafting policy around, all of these taxes? Because the fact that you and I are having a discussion means you're not 100% happy with where things stand. You've already articulated why you're not happy, but do the people on the other side, the policy and lawmakers, do they understand this line of argument? What is the possible pushback that they've given? And I say that because if we are at this point, if you and I are having this conversation, it means on the other side, there's either a non-alignment, of understanding, or, perhaps there's a pushback where it's like, listen, these are all just vapes, so we're just putting a blanket, we're just blanket approaching, this type of thing. So what are those engagements like? What are those discussions like with the policymakers? And have attitudes evolved, since you started doing this type of work?
I'm not quite sure, because I'll take every opportunity to try engage with members within the government, whether it be from Treasury or whether it be from the Health Department. With regards to vaping. So if we are given an opportunity to create we'll create a submission, obviously based around our own experiences, as well as include some of the statistics that we have and research that we've collected over the years from different parts of the world. And then obviously when there is some kind of opportunity to engage with policymakers and lawmakers through the channels, we will do so. That's very clear. It hasn't reached reached them in the way that we wanted it to be reached. But I believe that there's going to be a point where we see in all parts of the world where there is definitely a recognition that these products are beneficial with regards to reducing non-communicable diseases. We've seen this, for example, in New Zealand, the UK, even the United States. And in fact, even this morning, Chile announced amendments to their tobacco bill that clearly defines or differentiates the difference between combustible products and non-combustible products, which is a big win. But that's all based on data. So, we'll take every opportunity, and we are always open to have these discussions. But unfortunately, because it's seen and always deemed as a tobacco product, it's very clear that there is strong guidelines as to how they approach or how they speak about these products. I'd love to have a conversation like we're having here with individuals within those departments to understand why there's such an objection from that side and why we are not meeting in the middle somehow. Because we do strongly agree that there needs to be regulations around these products. We absolutely do not disagree with it at all. And we strongly agree with the fact that these products should not be made available to the youth. But I don't believe taxation is the way we should be doing it, because currently, if we look at the youth smoking rates in South Africa, where there is regulations, where there is severe tax, those rates are climbing because we are not missing the boat with regards to enforcing the regulations. We're missing the boat enforcing the collection of tax around combustible tobacco. I mean, it's widely documented that anywhere between 55 to 60% of products or cigarettes are now considered illicit. And if we look, for example, at the Global Adult Tobacco Survey of 2021, and you look at the data set itself, you'll understand that 67% of the cigarettes that were reported in that particular study were illicit cigarettes because they didn't meet the minimum collectible tax. So we're talking about an enforcement issue here. We're not talking about taxes helping it. We're not talking about regulations helping it. We can have all the regulations, we can have all the tax, but if we can't enforce it, that's the problem. When it comes to e-cigarettes and e-liquids, these are not homogeneous products. And in fact, a lot of e-liquids can be manufactured from home. So if we're going to force people to pay for these products, there's nothing really stopping them from making the products at home, which brings in a safety issue. It also doesn't talk about how these products are now being, you know, handled in the black market, which is, again, introduces a whole host of different problems with regards to safety. We know, for example, India has banned these products for a number of years, but India still has vapors and they're still selling vaping products. Unfortunately, we don't know what those products are. We don't know if they're safe because there's a big counterfeit market out there around these products. And unfortunately, when we start introducing measures like severe regulations and legislation, as well as excessive taxes on these products, it just emboldens the illicit market and black market to fill in the gaps. And unfortunately, the real true impact here is not the fiscus, it's people's health. And like we saw, for example, in 2019 with Diwali, where there was 68 deaths and 2,100 or 2,500 hospitalizations around what they considered to be vaping problems, the real truth behind it was an illicit, illegally made cannabis product that was vaped, and it used a vitamin E acetate, which is an incredibly common ingredient used for topical treatment. But as soon as you inhale that particular chemical, which is actually a lipid in oil, it causes insignificant damage to the lungs. And that's not nicotine vaping, that's THC vaping. And because of the regulations in that particular state that was introduced in, I think it was in Missouri, people started creating these liquids that were incredibly harmful and people died. And that's a policy fault. Because certain policies were put in with no understanding of the long-term or consequential impact of these policies, people died. People are now suffering because they were using a product that they thought was safe. They thought it was perfectly okay, but it came from an illegal source, and it came from a tainted source made by individuals, or drug dealers in this case, that had such a severe impact. And unfortunately, my biggest fear is we go down that same path, is that we create these products we create these policies that are so restrictive and so problematic for a legitimate trader, a legitimate business to make a living. It doesn't take away the product or doesn't take away the demand. It forces the demand to look in other directions. Australia is a perfect example. Over 90% of the vapors in Australia buy their products off the black market, because the only way you can buy a product in Australia or vaping product in Australia is through a pharmacy at excessively high prices. No one's doing that. And what we're seeing in Australia at the moment is that there's a tobacco turf war around nicotine vapes. And we're seeing shops, I think we're well over the 200 mark in terms of shops being burned, firebombed, because there's a turf war around these products. We've introduced, organized crime around vaping, which is intended to be a safer product to help people live a better life, particularly if they're smokers. Now turning into turf wars between gangsters in Australia. In Mexico, we've seen these products being sold by individuals that are related to other drugs. And that's all because of the policies and the regulations that we put on products. South Africa is a clear example of what we did in 2020 when it came to our response to COVID. We look at how we banned the tobacco products and alcohol products, what that did to the illicit trade, and how that horse was bolted. And unfortunately, I'm afraid that we're not learning from those lessons.
I completely understand, and I like the fact that you brought that specific example up, because I was literally going to say that the COVID-19 pandemic and lockdown restrictions literally are a big case study around what happens when you put restrictions on these types of things. Because to your point, it's not that you are dampening demand, you're just getting that demand to look elsewhere. And in South Africa, illicit cigarette trade is now widely known to be, quite widespread, to have been fortified during the COVID-19 pandemic, and to now be stronger than ever, because it almost reinforced, a certain type of behavior, within the consumer base. The other big party that we haven't spoken about when it comes to this is the tobacco companies themselves, right? You are an advocacy group. You've got lawmakers on the other side that you're engaging with. And right now there doesn't seem to be a meeting of the minds, clearly, right? Where are the tobacco companies in the debate? Because we've seen, quite a strong push from some of the cigarette makers into, the vaping and e-cig, types of products. So I'm sure it's in their interests as well, to try and be aligned to reduce some of these taxes and that type of thing. That's just me thinking about it. But your experience of the tobacco companies, because I would imagine that they have a different pull, a different sway when it comes to lawmakers. I think issues around the tobacco industries and their engagement with lawmakers around the world is well documented, and it's been a decades old, type of debate that's been going on. And it almost feels as if this moment that we're in with, vaping, non-combustibles, e-cigs, and, that umbrella of products is the latest, version of this debate that the tobacco industry has been having with lawmakers. So where are the companies themselves from what you're seeing?
Well, I think we need to understand that, first of all, the tobacco companies are not the inventors of vaping products. Mm. The vaping products was invented by a pharmacist in China, yeah, called Honlink. In fact, the tobacco companies only started showing some real interest 10 years after that invention.
Yeah.
And they obviously got to that point of what I typically call the Kodak moment, is when they established that based on what they were seeing with their own products and the popularity of vaping products, the sales are starting to drop. And in fact, we've seen these kind of results being reported around the world, where tobacco companies are seeing a reduction in their sales at a far faster rate than was typically in the past. And the only change really that we're seeing around here is the introduction of vaping products. And it's true that a lot of tobacco companies out there have gone into what we will term as safer alternatives. For example, Philip Morris has gone in very, very hard into the heat not burn products with the IQOS. They also introduced or just recently purchased the Swedish Match company, which produces nicotine pouches, which I think is now called Zyn. And we look at, for example, British American Tobacco. They introduced or at least have a product called Vuse. And Vuse is an electronic cigarette. And they've also gone into the nicotine pouch space, which is a product I think they're called Vila. Vila, I think it is. Vila. Within engagement, I think I really can't talk about that. I mean, we've heard some of their commentary for example, meetings at Treasury when we're discussing the tax. And I've seen them at a number of the public hearings around the bill talking about these products. I think we need to understand that we've heard and acknowledged that many of these giant tobacco companies, particularly Philip Morris and particularly Bat, have made a commitment to reduce their combustion products and replace it with electronic products or non-combustion products. They've made that declaration very clear and loud a number of years ago, and they're working very hard to bringing these products as the mainstay. The issue that I'm seeing with this is that if we're going to make these products place these products under such severe regulations, we're not incentivizing tobacco companies to move in that direction. And I'll give you a very good example. If we take the Federal Drug Administration in the United States, the FDA, they have a process called the PMTA, which is the Pre-Market Tobacco Authority or whatever. And what that enables you is provide data and statistics and research and the product specifications to this process, and the FDA will then approve these products for the sale within the United States. Now, the PMTA is specifically around vaping products. They have approved, I think it's 36 or 38 electronic products, and that's based on 26 million applications. So 38 out of the 26 million millions of applications. If we're going to make it so ownership and also if we're going to make it so difficult for these products to get approved, we're not incentivizing innovation, we're not incentivizing a move of a company in that direction. If we're going to just say, you know, everything is pointing to the fact is no, stick with your combustion, stick with your deadly cigarettes, we don't want you to move over to electronic devices, we don't want you to move over to combustion. Can you imagine we had the same approach when it came to, for example, vehicles? No. Volkswagen, Mercedes-Benz, BMW, you stick with combustion. You can't move over to electronic vehicles or EVs. Even though you have all the technology, even though that you have all the understanding, even though that you have all the research and science and expertise, you cannot move in that direction. You're forbidden. This is a market for new players. And I think that is fundamentally wrong. I think we need to include everybody around the table and have experts and understand that, yes, they are going to come from a different direction. They are going to come from a direction of protecting their own interests. But if we're going to prevent them from being part of the solution and have them stay in a space, for example, like cigarettes, I think it's going to be very, very problematic. I think they should be an important part of these discussions. But we also need to acknowledge that they do have a history, that they do have a problem. But we shouldn't be sitting there denying them the opportunity to provide their expertise and the knowledge, because we're now reaching a point in our civilization or in society where we can fact check everything. You know, it's not, you know, medicine is the same thing. We no longer require years and years and years of research. We can do it very quickly from a quick scan. That's the beauty of modern medicine. And that's the beauty of modern science, is that we do have the ability to check these things very easily. So that's a very long answer for something where I think that there is some kind of engagement. And the only engagement that I basically see is what we see at the public hearings and at these meetings.
All right.
That's not to say that there isn't engagement in the corridors or outside. I don't know. That's what I'm trying to say.
All right. Yeah, because I think on my side, the key thing I was trying to establish is that if we're looking at this problem, it would occur to someone that you've got your demand side, which is what you're essentially representing, which is the consumer's side of the equation. You've got the supply side, which would be the actual companies themselves that are supplying the market. And then government has to take a referee, type of role. And also firstly, they have to craft the rules, and then they have to then enforce the rules, right? To your earlier point about, enforcement and all of that stuff, right? So I was just trying to gauge whether, all three parties are on the same page about where it is we're trying to go. But
absolutely not. I firmly, based on what we've seen, is that government is reluctant to accept anything other than the fact that if it looks like a cigarette, quacks like a cigarette, then it has to be a cigarette. They've been very, very clear that, and even from a point where our current health minister had presented to the Portfolio Committee of Health, it said harm is harm, which just shows the level at which they're coming from, is that they don't see that there's a differentiation between these products. They don't accept that there is a difference in terms of the continuum of risk or where e-cigarettes fits on the harm spectrum. They don't acknowledge it. The way they are seeing it is pretty much what the World Health Organization sees it, is that because a tobacco company is involved in this, it has to be bad. It just has to be bad. So we're not seeing an acceptance from our Department of Health and our government that these products are significantly different. It's what really boggles my mind is if we go back to the research that was done by South African Medical Research Council under the Global Adult Tobacco Survey, GATS, 76% of the people who smoked that were surveyed showed some desire to quit smoking. And in South Africa, we don't have a smoking cessation strategy to speak of. We don't see nicotine replacement therapies under some kind of subsidy or some kind of public public health initiative. We don't see cessation clinics for smoking at our primary healthcare centers. I know that there's maybe one or two in our tertiary healthcare centers, like, for example, Groote Schuur. I think there's a new one that was established in Gauteng. But we don't see it where the people are on the ground at primary healthcare centers. We don't see those counseling sessions happening there. We don't see nicotine replacement therapies or pharmaceuticals to help people. We literally rely on people who smoke to use the most unsuccessful way of quitting, and that's cold turkey. And now we've got a product which has been proven to be incredibly successful at helping people quit smoking. In fact, if we go back to the Cochrane Systematic Reviews, which is widely considered the gold standard in medical research, they, with a very high certainty, are more effective at helping people quit smoking than nicotine replacement therapies. And for the life of me, I don't understand why we're taking those opportunities. If we have 76% of people wanting to quit, why aren't we taking every opportunity to help people quit with nicotine replacement therapies, with counseling, with pharmaceuticals, with safer alternatives like vaping and nicotine pouches and heat-not-burn products? Because at the end of the day, these people quit smoking. Surprisingly, we'll see a reduction in non-communicable diseases, which is effectively a very big line item in public health. When we start considering cancers, heart diseases, lung diseases, it's just incredibly, I baffles my mind is that we know all this data, we've got it in front of us, and yet we are reluctant to move across that bridge in order to achieve what we intended to achieve, is to reduce non-communicable diseases.
So that's how we end off today's discussion, and it's been a fascinating one and quite educational around what's happening in the vaping market as it relates to, you know, the wider, you know, the broader lens, you know, around, you know, let's call them non-combustible products when it comes to, you know, tobacco. It almost seems as if we are in the moment, you know, where there's a difference between how people think the market should be versus how the market actually is. And it almost seems as if that is the fight that is going on here. The market is the way that it is, rather deal with it based on the realities on the ground, as opposed to a measure of what you wish it was. It almost feels as if there's a disconnect that's happening between the main parties on the demand side, supply side, and the policy side when it comes to, you know, the vaping market. Some of the big things that Kurt was talking about was he gave us quite a good understanding, you know, of what the market is looking like, the broader umbrella around, you know, around the alternatives to cigarettes, talking about e-cigarettes, talking about vaping, but vaping specifically, and how it has been helping a lot of people to switch over, but also at the same time, a lot of the evidence suggesting that it can help, you know, to make people quit when it comes to smoking, or at least reduce the amount of nicotine that is being consumed. Now, they're advocating for lower taxes based on nicotine content. To say, as a person moves down that ladder of nicotine content, then surely we must be reducing the taxes that that they're using. But even bigger than that, you know, Kurt is saying that whilst they are doing that work to try and reduce taxes in line with nicotine content, that nuance is important to understand. But he is also then saying that in many cases, taxes are actually not, you know, the only way that you can actually solve this particular problem. I think in his words, he said it's not a taxation problem, but rather an enforcement issue that is happening on the ground, to say that a lot of rules are put into place, but sometimes, you know, those rules actually force demand to go look in other places. Or, you know, some of the rules themselves aren't necessarily enforced the way that they are. And one of the big things that they are warning against is that in the same way that we've seen a huge illicit trade of traditional cigarettes, South Africa might find itself going down that same path based on some of the evidence that they've seen. I think he mentioned countries like Australia, where a huge swath of what's going on in that market, you know, is actually happening on the black market. He mentioned a country like India, you know, where in essence the product is banned, but people are still consuming the product in one way or another. So, you know, they haven't really addressed the demand side of things, but rather, you know, you just come in and you just enforce laws that are punitive, as opposed to actually solving the problem at its source. I'm hoping that I have encapsulated the problem, and, you know, hoping that we'll see some movement, you know, on this particular issue. And it would be interesting to see how the debate continues over time and whether the government will have anything to say on the 12th of March when they table, you know, this year's budget for 2025, and how that debate is going to go on. But for now, to the point that Kurt made, there is a misalignment, and you know, because the tobacco industry is involved, Kurt just relaying the fact that it's been a little bit hard, you know, to engage and get the nuance to be understood, because there is that history that the industry has been involved in and associated with over time, and that has perhaps tainted, you know, some of the expectations that had been there. So that's how we come to the end of today's discussion. We were in conversation with Kurt Yeo. He is the co-founder of Vaping Saved My Life Consumer Advocacy Group. Kurt, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, sir. And you have a wonderful day.
And that's been it for this edition of the Business Day Spotlight. Remember that you can find our latest podcasts on Business Live. That's under the podcast Business Day Spotlight tab on Twitter with hashtag BD Spotlight. And remember that you can review and subscribe for free on iono.fm, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, wherever you choose to get your pods casted. Thank you to our amazing team. I've been Mudiwa Gavaza of the Business Day and Financial Mail. And this has been another edition of the Business Day Spotlight, which is a multimedia live production. So for myself and the rest of the team, it is good evening, good afternoon, and good morning.